Hey, everybody. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, where you can get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/radio. You'll find over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including today's biggest bestsellers, some I've read recently, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. That's a great book. Life by Keith Richards. A lot of good stuff there. Anyway, audibletrial.com/radio. And speaking of good books, and we were, I got to tell you, I've got a new one out myself this week. It's called Mind Over Business, and I wrote it with California sports psychologist Ken Baum. I hope you'll go and check it out. Maybe order a copy on Amazon.com. If you like it, you can certainly check the like button, share it with your friends. And it'll be coming to Audible.com very soon, so look out for that. And now, check out today's show. Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Paul Michael Glaser, author of the new children's novel, Crystalia and the Source of Light. Stick around. You may know this guy from his earlier career as an actor. Yep, that's right. I'm talking to Starsky from Starsky and Hutch. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of aging tough guys who still won't admit they ever sang along with David Soul in the shower in the Noonan Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Paul Michael Glaser's life as a public figure is entering its third act, by my count. First, of course, there was his big break as Perchik in the 1971 film adaptation of Fiddler on the Roof, followed by his years as a star of ABC's long-running series Starsky and Hutch, in which he played Detective Dave Starsky opposite David Soul's Detective Ken Hutch Hutchinson. The show was hugely popular in the 1970s, for those of you who weren't born yet, and when it aired new episodes and reruns, that propelled it into popularity for many years to come. Now, Glaser's second act was unplanned. His wife, Elizabeth Glaser, was tragically struck down by AIDS in 1994. Before dying, she bravely made her illness a public campaign for greater understanding and empathy for AIDS victims, putting a broader face on something many people preferred at the time to see only as something that affected or afflicted the gay community. Now, less well-remembered in the years since is that his daughter with Elizabeth passed very young from complications of AIDS, and their son contracted HIV in the womb but survived. Now, Glaser has kept his wife and daughter's spirit alive through his work with the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation. And now he's ready for a completely different turn on the celebrity stage, this time as the author of a children's novel called Crystalia and the Source of Light. Now, some elements of the fantasy story in Crystalia may ring true for people who have followed the Glaser story over the years, particularly its story of a mother of two adolescents wasting away before their very eyes. Now, Paul Michael Glaser, or as your byline reads on your book, PM Glaser, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. That was very interesting to listen to.
I hope some of it was true.
It was very well thought out, very well said. Thank you.
How did you get the idea to start writing juvenile fiction at this point in your life?
I was... About 12 years ago, I came up with an idea for a story, and I wrote it wrote this book as a screenplay. And then I discovered that the technology wasn't there to animate the properties of light. So I decided I was going to write it as a book. I don't know why. I wasn't that good as a screenwriter, and I certainly had never written a book before. So I said, great, I'm going to give it a whack. So I started writing, and it started growing, and it took me this long to write it. I think that in the process of writing it and realizing that this was a really good vehicle with which I could share what I had learned in this journey of my life, in the last 30 years, the last 20 years, I'd been looking for that kind of a vehicle for a long time. I always had people asking me, well, why don't you write about your life? Why don't you write about your life? I said, well, I would if I could remember it. I started to think along those lines. And the more I wrote, the more I realized that, you know, when I was a kid, my mother used to read to me all the time. And bless her heart, she read to me, you know, Uncle Remus and all kinds of things. And I really got in touch with what it was like to have a book read to the child in me. And so I decided to write to the child in all of us. Because I didn't want it just to be for kids. I didn't want to say this is just a children's book. Because it isn't. And as a matter of fact, you know, there are a number of elements in it that easily appeal to adults. And certainly the message, the core message of the book, which is, you know, what is the purpose of fear in our lives? And the answer that I proposed in the book, that's something that's very, very relevant to the world today. The world's such a scary place. Of course, the irony is that children are much more receptive and much more able to identify the presence of fear in their lives because they spend a fair amount of time in that place. As we get older, we tend to mask it over. We tend to paper it over. We allow our minds to go into denial. We say, I'm not afraid I'm angry, or I'm not afraid I'm depressed, or I'm not afraid I'm sad. But I think, you know, with a little bit of investigation, we can find that there's a fair amount of, there's a root fear that's going on beneath all of these feelings, because fear is a natural part of the human condition. And we are raised with this philosophy, at least in this country or in the Western society, there's nothing to fear except fear itself, which is an unfortunate misstatement as far as I'm concerned, because fear, as I have discovered, is not only is a natural state of man, but it is also, interestingly enough, an amazing fuel, amazing motivator. Not the motivator that we think, which is to run, but because of our innate ability to be conscious as human beings, it becomes an incredible tool that we can use, which is what I talk about in the book. So I went ahead and I said, okay, I'm going to write this book with the child in all of us. I'm going to push the vocabulary of the children, and I'm going to keep in mind the issues that we as adults deal with in our day-to-day life, and the presence of fear in our day-to-day life, and our denial or our refusal to acknowledge that it is there. It's for us to acknowledge it's there for our kids, but it's very hard for us to acknowledge it's there for us. So I wrote this book. It's designed very much in the classic tradition of Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, American entertainment, if you will. The character is all deliciously interesting and fun and whimsical, if I may say so myself. And so it's a very entertaining piece in a very novel world. And it's an ideal book for the family to take down from the shelf and read aloud to and with each other, especially Christmas, and that it is a Christmas story. It's the first of, there are four other titles that will follow it. It's a franchise. It is a franchise that that is very exciting to me because, you know, when you learn something that I think is very valuable, the ability to be able to get it out there in as many ways as possible is, you know, is really important. You know, I'm not sitting here proselytizing. I'm not saying that, you know, that I'm a guru or I've No. What I'm saying is, gee, I've learned something that's really valuable to me. I think it's of value to others, and I would like to share. So I shoot for the whole thing. I shoot for the kids. I shoot for the adults, and we'll see what happens.
Now, I know one of the things I've learned or have heard about children's literature over the years is that the editors of children's literature, they have very specific ideas about the kind of language you use for a certain age group and the number of words you use or the number of pages. It's all very diagrammatic, I guess. Now, you published this on your own. I wondered if that came up at all in the process of...
Yes, it did. And, you know, I worked with this group called the Greenleaf Book Group. They distribute out of Texas. They're one of the largest distributors of independently published books. And it was an interesting experience because I was all set. I signed the check to have a book printed in China. Because we printed an 11 by 14, a larger version. I'm amazed that I don't have the book right in front of me to show you. That is unbelievably... Okay, so that's short-sighted of yours truly. But this is the first time I've done a Skype entertainment. I'll probably run around the corner and grab one in about 2 seconds.
We'll take a break and let you do that in a minute, sure.
Okay, so anyway, so what were we talking about?
Pigeonholing of it, yeah.
So Greenleaf said, they read it, and they said, we'd like to distribute this for you. And which is a compliment, terrific. I said, fine. They said, we have, this is our appraisal of the book. And they sent me an analysis. And I looked at it, and they made about 4 or 5 editorial notes, conceptual and structural editorial notes. And they said, you don't have to do these notes, but we think it would help the book. And so I said, okay. And I'd already proofed it, and edited it, polished it. You know, it's a long, long process.
I know.
Looked at the notes and I went, you know something? In all honesty, every single one of these notes are things that I either tried to soft pedal or I swept under the carpet or my editors would fall in love with the book and so I could talk them out of anything, you know, or almost anything. And myself, that I had... really not paid attention to these notes as well as I should. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I tore the book open and I re-edited it again. And it was better. It is better. Now, they had their idea of how many pages it should be based on their research and based on the industry and all of that. I think the thing that's important to remember is that these are all guidelines. They're not rules. Mm-hmm. And you want to work with people that understand that so that you can discover together what the parameters are. You can discover together. You can say, well, let's push it a little bit here. You know, because I chose vocabulary many times. My primary editor is a two-time recipient of the National Endowment of Teachers Award. She's an extraordinary person and a talent. And she was beside herself with the potential of this as being a teaching tool. And many of the time we had a conversation. We said, well, is this word too much for a kid of such and such an age? Well, it's on the border, but you know something? It'll educate. And so I stretched them. And I stretched them there. And then another issue came up because all of the characters in this book, in this world that I've created, they all speak with different accents, French, German, Italian. And so I, being an actor, I phoneticized them.
I was going to ask you. Okay.
Yeah. So that when you read it, all of a sudden you're speaking with the French accent, you know, or the German accent, you know, you're speaking with these different accents. And that's kind of fun. And initially, I was a little too thick with the phonetics, you know. I was really a little carried away. So I had to sit it down and water it down and make it more comfortable. And there are still times when people go, well, you know, I got used to it, but it was... The interesting thing is we always want to be stretched. Do want that. within a comfortable margin, but we want to be stretched. And so that gave me the license to be able to play with my descriptive abilities and whatever abilities I have as a writer, apparently, to really, you know, really explore and push these things. So an answer, a long-winded answer to a very short question is, so much of the world, as in everything in life, operates on a need to define and control and say, this is what this must be. Mm-hmm. Our challenge. And so all rules, I feel, should be looked at as opportunities to identify potential parameters, but certainly not written in stone.
So I'm glad you mentioned about so many of the characters having these very different accents, and they're different gems and crystals and what have you. Did you have in mind anyone in particular as you did certain of the characters with their accents? Were you thinking of anyone in particular?
No, you know, it's interesting. As best as I can remember, memory is the variable here. As best as I can remember, I discovered the Audubon Book of Rocks and Minerals. When I was a kid, I loved geology, and I've always, you know, I got a collection of rocks from streams all over the world when I go fishing. I mean, I throw things in my suitcase and bring them home. And so I found this Audubon Book of Rocks and Minerals, and I looked at the back. The photographs are amazing. And the first thing you realize when you look at it, or I realized, was that any color, texture, hue, form, shape that I could possibly imagine in my mind already exists underground. Mm-hmm. And that the world of crystals and minerals, which 99% of the people relate to as, oh, there's my corner rock shop. I can go in there and get an amethyst, I can get a citrine, I can get a quartz, I can get, you know, a fossil or two like that. They don't realize that there's such an amazing world down there, and it is replete with all of this variety and et cetera. So I look at these rocks and minerals and I say, okay, and I go through and I say, pyrite. Pyrite is a really good name for a quartz jester, and it's made of all of those cubes, and if I had all those cubes balancing on each other, and then took the concept of them in motion or balancing on each other and make his eyes and nose and mouth balancing or wandering over and around his face. That's kind of where I went to. And then I looked at him and I thought, well, is there anything else I can do? And I thought, pyrite, 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 my name is pyrite. I threw my name, is pyrite. I am a jester, don't laugh at me. He all of a sudden has a Puerto Rican accent, if that's an approximation of a Puerto Rican accent. You know, and then King Beryl, the blue, the rare, the true, who's the king, and, you know, and he's an ex-warrior, and he's very rigid, and he's all about rules. So I said, well, rules, 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 ajam, das. Everything has rules. Ruled in and ruled out. Ruled up, ruled down, ruled in, ruled out. So he became, one of his sons is the Orange Prince, and the Orange Prince is a very, very introspective and very very much part of the world of vanity, narcissism. And I thought it would be really interesting if I'm the Orange Prince. I like to think. I like to think a lot. And I like to be polished. You know? And I gave him a minute of dandy, and I gave him, you know, a shoe collection and wonderful clothes. And he's very into being. He's trying to be as a prince. But he's the second most rare. The first most rare is his brother, the warrior prince. And the warrior prince is a red prince. And I just automatically went to red prince, the red prince, the Russian. You know, Mother Earth, I am the Red Prince. Sapphire Prince, you know. He's, so I, you know, each one kind of evolves, you know. I even had one with a British accent, but the character was we got rid of the character. We felt like there were too many characters, and it got a little confusing. You know, I think a lot of it was I drew enormously on my own theatrical literary life's background. Okay, so while in the Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, one of the things that really struck me, and always struck me, was the degree of whimsy that allowed the author to explore so many things said, so many intentions, so many ideas put forth, and couched in humor, couched in idiosyncrasy. So I thought, that's really a good chance. I'm going to have fun doing that. And so, I just let my imagination go. And the guards down there, the basalt guards, and Princess Amethyst has his own personal guard. And when everyone starts to ask him what his name is, his name's Baz. Mm-hmm. Alt Baz. And I thought I'd really put some cherry on the top, and I decided to make him Toshiro Mifune, Japanese.
Oh, yeah. So,
my name is Baz. How about you? What are you? And that's how all of these things evolved.
And what about in terms of the story? I kind of said in the introduction that there's a sense that a lot of this comes truly from the heart in terms of these kids. They go on this mysterious, fantastical adventure. But basically, I mean, it takes them out of their real, their dire lives. Their mom's terminally ill. The bank is foreclosing on their home. Am I overstating it to say that at least a sense of that, I don't know about the foreclosing on the home, but some of the other parts, feels like, you know, what I know of, you know, of your own story, that there's some elements there that seem kind of familiar.
Very much so. Very, very much so. As a matter of fact, I often say, when people say to me, I should write my life, I say, look, I'm writing metaphorically what I've learned about my life and about life and death. And I think that the common theme between my life and the book is what these kids are experiencing and what I experience, which is noise. Sounded like someone was cracking a tape pressure.
It was actually my daughter is helping me. The dog started acting up, so she stepped in to help out.
Yeah, wow.
That digital sound, boy, it picks up everything.
Amazing.
She's a room away.
What it has in common with my life and the parallel between the book is that these kids are dealing with helplessness. Helplessness, I believe, just my thought, I believe that helplessness is the key fear. It's the only fear. I think all the others are cousins, poor cousins and relatives. But helplessness in the face of our mortality is our human condition. And if you would imagine that as a button, so whether you are mortally in danger or whether you're in a traffic jam and late for an appointment, you're still helpless. You're experiencing it. So you may not be pushing the button as hard, but it is being pushed. Now, what you do with it is something else. Usually, if you blame it on somebody else, or you get angry in that instance, in the traffic jam, that's where you would find someone saying, oh, I'm not helpless. I'm not even afraid. I'm angry. Because the mind does not want to acknowledge helplessness, because if you acknowledge helplessness, you're going to fall down this black hole and it's all going to be over for the rest of your life. You're going to just be helpless, 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 which is not true. But that is the illusion that the mind presents, because the mind has no way to cope with helplessness. It has no answer except to blame it on somebody, either blame it on yourself or blame it on other people or circumstances, situations. That's the only way the mind can deal with that fish. So I put the kids in a place of helplessness. And the mother's voice speaks to that helplessness, because as an adult, she has gone to a point of she's gone through all, you know, those wonderful stages that they're not wonderful, but they are real, that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross points out. And she's gotten to acceptance. Mm-hmm. She's gone through the denial. She's gone through the anger. She's gotten to acceptance. And in that place of acceptance, she's able to speak to the kids indirectly, speak to their fear. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she tries directly. And the girl often, you know, she says at one point, Maggie says, your mom would always talk to us. She'd always tell us stories of kings and queens. And she talked to him. She talked to Jesse as if he was an adult, you know, which as far as she's concerned was a waste. Adult. And she's trying to get them to understand, at least have an inkling of how to deal with this helplessness. And then, of course, they go down into that world, and Princess Amethyst becomes the mother's voice. And all these people in that world where light is failing, the light is failing, and they're all helpless. And they're either denying that the light is failing, or they're blaming on something, or they're questioning their own level of faith and belief. Maybe they're at fault. You know, and all of them from the Holy Clear, which is basically the keeper of memory, and he's the spiritual father or leader of the world down there. You know, everyone has their own way of dealing with this. And I thought that's really interesting. And so that became the kind of handle for, you know, who's the bad guy here? The real bad guy. What's the monster? And the monster is the helplessness. And how the kids learn to deal with that or relate to it, and what they experience. And Jesse's experience at the guidance of his mother, and Maggie's experience at the guidance of Jesse, because he shares with her what he's learned, give them a physical experience, an actual tactile experience that allows them to understand where faith comes from, allows them to understand what it feels like to feel yourself one with everything. And when you feel that, you are not helpless. You understand that you have a choice. You have an ability as a human being to come from your conscious place, your aware place, see that you're afraid, and choose not to condemn yourself or to blame yourself or blame anybody else, but choose to acknowledge and acknowledge what a courageous act it is to be human. What a courageous act to carry on in the face of your mortality, which you have no control over. And from that place of compassion, you can find compassion for others. The purpose of fear in our lives becomes our opportunity to remember our aware or our conscious self. And from that place, choose love. And it's not a helpless place at all. It is a divine place. And it is a place that is a tool that when I learned it, and I've been practicing it for a long time, it's not something you do overnight. You forget it constantly. You always forget. You get in the middle of your soup and you go, oh, why me? And all this is awful. And you're convinced that this it's all over and you're done for and whatever. It takes a while to remember, oh, that's right. Thank you for this opportunity to remind me that I have this conscious place as a human being. This place. There is something I can do. I can choose to have compassion for myself and for others. I can choose love. That became for me, because that's the lesson that I've learned in dealing with my wife's passing, my daughter's passing, my son's ongoing vulnerability to the HIV virus. And it's how I learned always taught to move through my terrible helplessness and move on.
Now, Paul, listening to you, I mean, you sound today like someone who's, you know, pulled this all together. You've had a lot of time to reflect. You've thought this all out. 20 years ago, when you were in the midst of all this terrible stuff that you went through, maybe a little more than 20 years, were you this collected about it? Were you this? You were like the rest of us, dealing with it on the spot, where the walls are coming down.
Absolutely, I was petrified. I was angry at myself. I was angry at the world. I had a lot of rage. A lot of rage. And I'm picking my nose on camera. The interesting thing is that the rage that I had, I came to realize, had a language that dated back to my childhood. Because for various and sundry reasons, my own mother, who I loved dearly and was an extraordinary woman, was very conflicted and had a lot of issues that she had to deal with. And she was very angry. And I felt that as a child. And I always tried to help it. I always tried to change it. I always tried to find my way into it and say, you know, is this okay? Is this enough? Is this? So I was dealing with helplessness from very early on. And then I started to realize, wait a minute, we're all dealing with helplessness on one level or another. We all deal with this. But it took a long, long time and a lot of work for me to get to where I am now. And to be perfectly honest with you and candid, I am extremely surprised by it. By what I've learned and by what I've been able to articulate and what I'm able to share. For the first time in my life, I have something that truly comes out of me. It's not original. It's not like I thought of this myself. Mm-hmm. I am a vehicle. I'm a conduit to sharing this. What I think is really pertinent and valuable information with the rest of humankind. I'm not the first, and I won't be the last, please God. But there is something here that resonates deeply with me. And yeah, in the beginning, I was like all of us, and I still have moments. I haven't transcended my humanity. I can get as pissed off and as scared as the next guy, lady. I can get as depressed and lost. The interesting thing is that as I work at this more and I get older, I remember in shorter period of time, that's what I was saying before about being in the soup. When I'm in that place, I can remember faster. It's less time for me to go, oh, that's right, thank you, thanks for this opportunity. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, I was very scared and would not even acknowledge how scared I was. I was angry because I was being asked to acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And so the way I'd fight against my fear was to blow up. I just yell. I'd get into arguments with, you know, whomever I was trying to take me kicking and screaming to drink from the well.
Let me change gears a little bit on you, and I want to ask you about the actual writing itself. But before I do that, this may seem like I'm going off topic. I'm hoping I'm making a connection here. But right before we went on, I mentioned to you that I had actually forgotten that you had been in Fiddler on the Roof way back when, playing Perchik. What was it that Perchik was planning to be when he went out in the world and grew up?
Wanted to be a teacher.
I
think he wanted to be a teacher.
Teacher. I was thinking a teacher or a writer. In some ways, I mean, you've kind of, I hate to connect you to a single role, probably not the role you think of, but I mean, I'm looking at you and I'm listening to you describe this, and I remember Perchik as being the young man who had all the dreams and the things he wanted to do, and I feel like I'm getting a little bit of Perchik a little older.
I don't think that's unusual or unfair. I think it's very accurate. I think the thing that that about Perchik that was so interesting to me was that he was an idealist. He believed these things to be true, these things to be self-evident, these things being whatever he,
right.
whatever he understood about life and like that. And he knew it. He knew it. And I think ever since I was young, I've always known there's something more. There's an answer. There's something more. There's got to be something more. And I took a long, torturous route to get there. But when I went through this whole thing with my wife and daughter and all of that business, and when I learned what I learned, I went, oh, that's it. That's it. And so all the conflict and the struggle that had gone through in my life, it's still there because I'm convinced. I know it. And Perchik is an idealist and he's a man who's willing to put his life on the line for something he believes because his conviction is so deep and is so strong. And the thing that we like about Perchik, I believe, is that idealism. That idealism and Huddle falls in love with him for it, etc. So I think that's an interesting point, and I think it's a valid point.
Well, of course, he and not to go into the whole Fiddler thing, but he and Tevye are the ones who stand out in the play because they believe differently than everyone around them, and so what they say and what they think stands out. I think
that's interesting. Yes,
they kind of push it through.
And Tevye sees that in person.
Right. And he admires that, and so he decides to, over his wife's objections, he decides to support this union. I make my living as a writer, and there was something I heard when I was very young that I always come back to when I'm struggling with it, and it's that someone said, it is easier to have written than to write. And now you've been through a book. Is it? And you're planning to do several more in the series, but is it easier now than it was when you started out to even think about going back to the well?
Well, you know, that's interesting you should ask that. I just finished writing a letter to somebody, or an email in these days, right? We don't write letters anymore, we write email. And I was saying how, you know, I wrote, in the middle of writing Crystallia and The Source of Light, but in the middle of that, I finished a draft or something, and I ended up writing another book, which I'm illustrating myself right now.
Really?
Which is in the same vein of being a book that can attract children and adults, but it's totally different, and it's more whimsical and humorous, although when I was writing it, I had no idea it was going to become as moving and emotionally moving as it became. When I finished doing my last proof on Crystallia, now I'm kind of wearing a businessman's hat, right? I'm left brain a lot of the times now, whereas I never was left brain. I was a right brain creative person. I found it very difficult to sit myself down and work on my third novel, which I'm halfway through. And from my experience in life, my first reaction was, oh my God, I don't want to write anymore. I want to go find something else to do. Mm-hmm. I expressed myself as a writer. However, I would never say that my acting days are over. I would never say that my directing days are over. So I relate to it as being a fallow period, a period where I'm going through, and my ability to communicate and my ability to explore, to analyze, or to express, tell a story, will always be there. I just have no control. Help. I have no control over what my output is going to be. I can only keep myself as present as I can and express myself. And how it ends up, it ends up. I mean, that's how I eventually related to my acting career and my directing career, which is you don't know what's going to cross your path. And what's going to pique your interest, what's going to challenge you, you know. It's always important to try to find the parallel between your own life and the creative exercise you're involved in. You know, as an actor, painter, writer, whatever. I mean, it's incredibly valuable. So you know that yourself. Oh, look at me. I'm exploring this, this, this in myself. Now you have a reason to be doing it. It's not just, I want to write because I want to write. It's not a vague thing. It's you always try to find, I believe it's important to always try to find what it is. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? What am I looking for? And let your protagonist be looking for that and explore it with them. So, you know, the point you make about Fiddler is a valuable point.
And so I have to ask you, mechanically, how did you actually do your writing? You're comfortable enough that you're sitting with me on Skype video, so I'm guessing you probably used a computer, but maybe not.
Well, I did, but I do a lot of longhand on a legal pad. Mm. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll just start writing. When I go dry, when I don't know what I want to write or how to write, I will write about that. Hmm. Because that's what is. And I learned that from somebody. I learned it in acting, and I learned it in writing. If I am sitting here and I don't know where to go, I will write, my character will not know where to go. Mm-hmm. And I'll write my reality, and before I know it, I'm back on track. And I'm not only back on track, but I've discovered something new. I've discovered another layer. But I will write. And the other thing I'll do is I'll let characters talk to me. Because one of the gifts I have, having been an actor, is I'm fairly good with dialogue. So I can express what the character is dealing with or trying not to deal with through the dialogue. And so a lot of times I can have the characters, I can talk to them, and I'll do it in longhand. And two interesting things about that was that years ago, when Elizabeth was dying and trying to work her way through the whole, got turned on to a palm reader, a palmist, and who did handwriting analysis and all of that business, and everyone swore by her. I'm of the belief that anything the human mind can think of, imagine, has existed, will exist, or does exist, depending on what plane of existence you want to identify. And so I said, sure, I'll say yes to that. I'll go along with everything. So we went to her, and she asked me to write something down. I wrote it down, and she looked at my writing, and she said, you know, it would be really interesting if you would try to write without crossing any letters, except the T and the X. And I thought, well, I'll try it. And what happened was I had to write slower. I never had good handwriting. And I had to write slower. And I realized immediately that my need to write fast, to scribble, came from my fear that I was going to forget. And I had to get it down quickly. And that when I forced myself to write slower, which I had to do in order not to cross any lines, except X's, it forced me to be A, very present, and B, to realize that many of the things I was concerned about writing, I didn't need to be written about. I didn't have to talk about it. I could, if I stayed with what was and not try to control what it was going to be, express what was at the moment, I could experience a truth and with myself, and I could stay true to what I was trying to express. I may not have any control over it, that's fine, but what was necessary got written, and what wasn't necessary or proved not to be necessary was forgotten. The second lesson I learned, of course, now I've forgotten what the second lesson was. I love it. Don't you love your memory? Well, it's like, you know, it's like this this very pretty girl who you meet, and she sometimes shows up and sometimes doesn't. anyways, it'll come to me. Yeah. It'll come to me. But started writing in longhand more and more, you know, trying to slow myself down and like that. Oh, I know what the other thing was. I hired this very talented illustrator. He did all the illustrations of the book. His name's Dave Zabowski. And Dave, he was trying to draw the characters. And so I said, well, look, I'm going to just sit on the couch over here. I couldn't see what he was drawing. And you interview me as the character. So he started asking me questions, as if he was like Letterman or somebody, and asking me questions about the, and he's addressing the character in me, and I was answering him, and he was drawing him. So I got a chance to use my acting ability and my imagination to be able to give the character some voices and give him more life.
As you did earlier when you introduced us to the characters.
Ah, yes. Well, there you are. Yeah.
So, I want to change gears slightly, and I was hesitant, wasn't sure whether to ask you about this or not, but you seem comfortable with the subject. Over the years, you've spoken out about Elizabeth and the AIDS, the Pediatric AIDS Foundation, a lot, and for the public face, you had to talk about her at the end of her life a lot and dealing with the illness. But I wondered, I mean, when you think about her now, and you know, obviously time has gone by, do you think about her and remember her at that point in life or earlier, you know, before things changed so much? Which Elizabeth do you remember the most?
Oh, well, I don't know about the most. I would probably say the earlier in our relationship I remember most. I mean, my memories of her decline and my memories of her last times is very, very, very much there. I see it and I know it. And I never thought before which I remember most. It depends on the point I'm trying to make. I don't know. You know, she was an extraordinary human being. She was not a saint. She's been sainted because we as people need to make others into saints and gods. It's just the human condition again, speaking out. She was very brave. She was very driven and very talented in something, especially I used to kid her all the time. She was the camp counselor. She'd organize everything. She was a great organizer. And she was a very bright woman, and she was very caring. She was a very good mother. And so, you know, it's interesting that it almost becomes incumbent upon me when I think of her is to remember that this was a human being and lives as a human being inside me, inside her son, her brother, whoever else knew her. And as human beings, we are perfect, but we're imperfect. Well, we're perfect in our imperfection, if you will, and we all have to find our way, muddled way through this journey we call life. And you know, the thing to remember is that she ended up having to do this, find this way in this journey, as the wife of a celebrity.
Right.
She had to do it as a public image, a public figure. And as a public figure, she found the way, and she should be credited 1,000% for this. She found the way to use that visibility to motivate other people, to get people off the dime, to get people at the Congress, the White House, America, corporate America, everyone to respond. And did it with a lot of integrity, you know. And I think that has to be factored in. That because when we make people saints, when we make people gods, which is the whole celebrity thing we have in our culture. You know, I often used to say until I got tired of trying to explain it to people. People say, "What's it like being a celebrity?" I said, "Well, people create their gods in order to eat them."
Right. Put them up on a pedestal so you can slowly chip away at it.
chip away, you know, whether it's, can I have your autograph, or can I have a picture of you, or can I be in a picture of you, or can I have a piece of your clothing? Can I have that communion wafer?
Does that happen?
The body of Christ.
Yeah.
Well, when people go to church, and part of the whole service
right.
is take communion, and having the wafer, and the right? Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah.
That same need to become, to feel like you're in me and I'm in you and we're all one. So if I make you a god, someone who has been able to deal with the fear and the challenge of dying and mortality and everything like that, if I say, my God, look at this wonderful person, and now I can have a piece of you, and I can eat it, touch it, then I can feel like I'm capable of doing that as well. So we take people, we stick them up on a pedestal, and that's not bad, it's not good, it's just the reality of how we function as human beings. We are all of us, at some level or another, scared that we can't do it ourselves, that we're alone. And we seek ways to feel our community with fellow men. We seek ways to feel that we're all together. Ironically or paradoxically, we oftentimes seek ways which define ourselves as different from other human beings, as special, as being not like everybody else, in a almost infantile belief that if we do that, then we can identify or support that part of us that we want to believe can transcend our fear. Can do like the saint does, do like the God in us does.
You've been through, I've been married almost 25 years. We've all been through things. We've been married with someone for a long time where that person becomes ill, you become ill. The difference in your situation is that your wife became ill in a very public way, and you lived this out for many years. And what I wondered is, I don't want this to sound cruel, but I have to admit, I was curious, after so many years of being the face of the, you know, Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation and speaking on behalf of it and keeping Elizabeth's memory alive, your daughter's memory alive, you know, has there been a day or days where you've just said, you know, I put so much time and energy into this, I'd now like to walk away, I did what I could do, I want to be somebody else for a while, I don't want to have to keep... this is part of my life day to day?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I stepped down after, I don't know if it was 6 or 7 years on the board, the foundation. I stepped down and became honorary chair. The foundation has gone through a lot of changes since then, and I'm very proud of what we were able to do while I was there. But I made that decision. Mm-hmm. I totally made that decision. I said, you know something, I have to go on with my life. I will support whatever's going on there, and I will speak to it. And people want me to speak to it, I'll speak to it. And I'll let them know my 2 cents. And when the foundation is struggling with something and they want to hear my opinion, I'll let them know. And sometimes I'll let them know when they don't want to know. But I did make that decision. I definitely made that decision. Because, you know, we are not any one thing in our lives. We are not any one thing. We are a mixture of so many things, and our life takes so many takes a journey on so many different paths. And if we're willing to accept that, then we don't become prisoners of our own identification, our own narcissism, our own need to say, this is who or what I am. I don't know who or what I am. I only know what I feel right now, and I only know what I see my mind struggle with in the past and try futilely to control in the future. I think it's very important that we have to understand the fluid nature of our existence, because when we start to define who and what we are, we limit ourselves. We limit our ability to be open to whatever is coming down the pike that's going to make us, make us fuller and richer.
Well, and this will be probably the worst segue in the history of segues, but talking about different chapters in life, we've kind of gone backwards from the way I introduced it. I introduced when we started talking about the acting and Starsky and then Elizabeth and then the book, and then in conversation we've gone from the book to Elizabeth, and now I have to bring it all the way around to back to acting and Starsky. I wondered, and it's sort of the same question, I guess, strangely, if you know, in after the show, the series ran, I think, 75 to 79, did you go through the same kind of love-hate relationship that even, I was thinking, I guess the best example was Leonard Nimoy as Spock in Star Trek, where up and down over the years, sometimes I'm not Spock, yes, I am Spock, I'm this guy, leave me alone, don't talk to me about that stupid thing anymore, or, you know...
You have to, yes, you have to have all of those feelings. You know, the interesting thing about film is that it memorializes something. It sticks it on, you know, it's frozen. And, you know, the good news is that if you're doing something that that has a timelessness about it, or let's not say timelessness, let's say a truth about it, if you're able to affect any degree of truth in your presence in front of the camera. And I was blessed to do that to some extent, because that's the extent to which the piece has moved on. And David, my partner, was able to do it also. That's the extent to which people respond to it. They feel it. They see it. They think it. They think they know it. They understand it. They believe it. And they are attracted to it. So, you know, while film will memorialize and make you a thing, a static thing, and something that appears to be quantifiable and qualifiable and everything, it is also memorializing something that you've captured or you've expressed through your craft, through your personality. And I think it's important to be able to recognize that. I didn't recognize it for a long time, and then, you know, now I look back on it and I say, you know, I know that much of what I wanted so to do was done. I was able to communicate, not in the way, to the degree that I thought I wanted or needed to. You know, we always fought with the producers. We always fought to make the show a better show, and you know, and there was, you know, plenty of contention and plenty of struggle. And yet it's there. It's there. And I think that it's only natural. You know, that it's interesting that while our mind would have stasis be the rule. Don't change anything. Mm. Want everything just the way it is, right? Because change is the only is probably the only universal. Everything always changes. That's thing we know from the get-go. We may not want to acknowledge it every minute, but change is the constant. So it's important to be able to honor that and honor the ability, that honor that fluidity, you know. And I think probably one of the things that's interesting about film or tape or whatever, any kind of recording device, is that it while it does memorialize, it's also memorializing in a fluid form. It is in motion. And two of the things get captured there is, number one, the illusion of reality. You look real to me right now, right? So the illusion of reality, which you can mess with, and you can push and pull and squeeze, and you can do all the wonderful things that technology and film has learned to do. I keep forgetting my thoughts. It's really bizarre. It captures that, the illusion, but it also captures that fluid experience of being alive. And when that connects, then we call it being present, the here and now. And we connect to it as an audience, as a viewer. We look at the eyes, we say, we don't even say it out loud. We might say out loud, I don't know, I just like that person, or I just feel like I feel kinship with that person, or I feel something. And what we're feeling is their humanity, and film as a medium has captured that. So, you know, that's the good news. Okay. You know, now part of humanity that would say, okay, now I want to describe it, pigeonhole it, and put it up on a pedestal, and memorialize it, and hold it, and have a piece of it. That part of humanity will then say, you are this kind of a person. You are that kind of a person. You are Star Trek. You are this, that. Or you are Leonard Nimoy, and you are in Star Trek. And we all want to be able to measure and control and define what it is that we see and we experience. And so, we don't realize that when we're doing it, we're bringing our reality to it, which is why someone will come up to you as a celebrity on the middle of nowhere and they say, oh my God, it's so great, you don't know. And they immediately assume that you know them as well as they know you in a basic way, because they've spent so much time with you. Mm-hmm. Oh, and spending the time with you, what they're doing is they've been bringing their reality to what their version of what you are. So as a performer, when you know that stasis is death and doing the same thing over and over is death, as an artist, as, you know, and you want to stay fluid and you want to be, allow change to happen, allow these things to happen, anybody's need to define you. Oh, you, what was it like? And tell me, and you are this. You are, you know, Spock. You are. It gets kind of exhausting because we don't want to be that. We want to be, I played, and there are parts of Starsky and me because I played character. Mm-hmm. But that's what I want to do.
All right. Well, so you stepped out for a second, and you've got a copy of the expanded edition of the book. How do we describe this luxury?
I'm going to give you two. I'm going to show you the what we call the manuscript edition.
Okay.
And this is the cover of the manuscript edition.
Oh wow!
All right.
That is special.
And this is the cover and what it looks like. And this is a pretty amazing piece of work, I must say, because the people who helped me put this together and dreamt of this, and so we used a four-color printing process in China, and I gotta watch the screen.
Wow.
And so the pages look like parchment, you know, and then, instead of trying to turn it, I will, and then it has these illustrations that are really...
Wow. It gives it kind of a Middle Earth, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit kind of feel.
Well, it certainly, hopefully, elevates it. I we did black and white illustrations, the inside of those, I'll show you in a minute, of the book, is the crystal courtroom.
Wow. Oh, look at that.
So we did these, we wanted to kind of tone the classic element. You know, I remember when I was kids and I'd read these books, they would, I'm just looking to see if there's something else to do. We have a whole bunch of illustrations in here.
Well, I'll show people while you're doing that, I'll show them this.
Pull that out, that's right.
Yeah, this is the, I hope I'm turning the right way. The,
you're
see
doing,
the screen. But the, this is the inside of the book jacket. Has all
right.
The color illustrations that help, for people who think to even look and see the note that you should look, you can get a real, real sense that way of the characters.
Right. It's it was an ingenious idea that Bill Wallen, who's the brains behind the launch, came up with that idea, and that's the inside cover of this book here. Mm-hmm. This here fella. And, the idea was, well, we wanted to tone the black and white classic nature of illustrations going way back when you had leather-bound books. I mean, if I could have afforded it, I would have made this a leather-bound book.
A little costly.
A little costly. We're eventually going to get, we're going to take this book here, combine these two, and we're going to make this into a coffee table version. So it'll kind of look like something that came out of the Dead Sea Scrolls, something that's like some archaeological artifact. We've talked of everything about making a box, a light box. So when you open the box up, the book sits in the box with light coming up from around the edges. And then you take the box out, you have a duplicate of all the illustrations, backlit, colored illustrations. Because I think one of the things that people aren't aware of, when you look at photographs on your computer screen, they're all backlit. And the colors look beautiful. One of the big challenges was, well, how do you get the color that, you know, when you go to the Museum of Natural History and you see the minerals and crystals and the kids look at them and you see the kids light up and the child in you lights up, what you're lighting up about is you're lighting up about the way the light interacts with material, with the crystals, and how it moves through them and refracts. So if you backlit a bunch of photographs, you'd get more of a sense of that life, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to make as a story point that light comes from within all of these people, and then how it comes from within is something that is, you know, they went down to this world with a flashlight, and they turned the flashlight on, and it's a question of whether it's the flashlight that created light down there, where there is no light, and all of a sudden there's light, or whether it's something else. And that, of course, is, well, what's the source of light? And it's cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very cool. Yeah. All right, so I'm gonna switch to that. I want to ask you just a couple of Starsky and Hutch things. And I'll let you out of here, but I have a friend, a very good friend, Sean Wood, heard that I was going to talk to you. Like I grew up with the show, had a couple of questions, so I want to throw them out at you, simple questions. The simplest being, he wanted to know what kind of shoes you wore as Starsky, because he and his buddy had a pair of them, and they both wore them to, you know, to nothing.
They were Adidas. They were Adidas running shoes. Hmm. Adidas at the time was just growing, and they came to us with a collection. They had a fold-out. I remember nowadays it would be a book. They had a fold-out with about, I don't know, 25, 30 different styles. And so I chose the one I liked the most. I wanted a running shoe. I wanted something I could run in. Unfortunately, it had no support, so I ended up paying for that. But that's what that was.
And then Sean's other question was, he was aware of the directing work you've done, the TV episodes. I know you did some Miami Vice, and more recently, Robbery, Homicide, Investigation, I think was the show. Michael Mann's show, again?
Yeah, I've directed a bunch of episodic. I started out doing Starsky and Hutch, and then when the show was over, I decided I want to become a director, and so I started directing some episodic. Michael Mann, who had worked on Starsky and Hutch, he produced Miami Vice and asked me if I wanted to direct some of those episodes. I said, sure, why not? And I directed for him, and then he had a feature film come up that he needed a director for, and he asked if I wanted to direct it. And that started my feature career. And then after my feature career kind of went south, I said, okay, I was going to write. I'd taken it south myself. I actually took a project that was that a studio wanted to do of mine, and I said, I'm going to write it myself. And then I didn't realize that I wasn't that good a screenwriter yet. I didn't have any sense of structure. And so, after some years of being away from the camera, some of my team suggested, they said, well, why don't you go throw your head back in the ring and direct some more episodic? So I started directing episodic again, and I did that up till about 2 years ago. Nothing was quite as, although I must say I directed a couple of third watches, which I, the closest to my experience with Miami Vice as possible. And Michael Mann, bless his heart, instilled an atmosphere, or created an atmosphere, because the first series being filmed away from Hollywood and in Florida, which had never had a series in Miami. But they were very accommodating. Mm-hmm. And And we were able to do just about anything we wanted to do. So it wasn't a severely controlled environment, which the television today and the writer-producers and the lawyers, they've put everything down so that they do everything in triplicate and their permission to say yes or no or change a word or whatever it is. So I didn't fit really well into that world. And you know, unfortunately, the reality of doing a episode more a cop than you are a director. But it was a joy. I mean, it's all enjoyable. It's all a good experience. All
right. And the last question. There was a couple of years ago, Starsky and Hutch came back. We had the movie with Ben Stiller playing you and Owen Wilson playing David. Was your first reaction? Were you excited? Were you thinking victory lap for the characters? It's going to live on? Or did you think, let's get past this?
Well, my first reaction, you know, before they did, they've been trying to do a movie of Starsky and Hutch for a long time. And their option was running out. And I came up with an idea for doing it as a feature with David and I. And for a lot less money than they were going to spend on it. And I got Bill Blinn interested. He's the creator. But when the time for his option to expire came up, Warner Brothers, because Ben Stiller had a passion to do this, Warner Brothers bought the rights outright. They stopped renewing. They just bought it outright. And then, Ben was nice enough to, say, he wanted to have lunch with me. And we talked. And I think that, I know his heart was in the right place. And I know, Owen, they're both terrific people. And Ben's a really good mind. He really captured an awful lot about the way I moved and talked and everything like that. But at the end of the day, the movie that they wanted to do, or that I know Ben wanted to do, which paid a little more, he wanted to try to capture the chemistry, the emotional relationship between the two characters. And that kind of gave way to the director's desire to do a little contemporary spoof.
Right.
That's what he did. At the end of the day, I basically related to the whole experience as being a compliment. I mean, I was part of something that became iconic, and this was a tip of the hat to that that experience. And so, I appreciate that it was done, and I would have done it differently, but I probably wouldn't have been able to do it like they did it, and they were unable to do it the way I did it.
Right. A little less, I suspect, a little less spoof and a little more focus on the action, and we'd probably have a series of those now. But
But I think the thing that created the longevity in Starsky and Hutch was the chemistry between David and I.
Right, but it wasn't necessarily making fun of yourselves. It was that. You had that chemistry, and
you had the chemistry, and you had all the levels. I mean, you got to look at, I played everything from whimsy and silliness to tragedy, and David did too. So that kind of dimension and that kind of sense of vulnerability and play and all of that was I think to a great extent what was responsible for the success of the series.
And the movie was fun for what it was. It just wasn't.
Absolutely. I saw it in London, actually. I went to the premiere over there, and I laughed.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. Why? What's not to enjoy? It's both very charming, talented people.
Right, absolutely.
And so it was, as I say, it was a compliment.
No, and you never know. Someone may later come back and take another crack at it with another approach.
It was also incredibly, a part of its time. You can't read the 70s, I mean, you can, and if you're really courageous, you can go back there and try to capture the vulnerability, the gullibility of the times. you know, we were still a nation that was going, well, we did win the Second World War, and we, you know, yeah, Korea was a problem, but, you know, in Vietnam, we're trying to get out of, but our president doesn't lie to us, and you know, we were still struggling with our idealism, and we were still babes in the woods as a society, and so a relationship like this was able to thrive in the face of, you know, conformity and bureaucracy and all of that.
Well, this was a lot of fun. I want to tell everybody that you can find Paul Michael Glaser's first novel, Crystallia and the Source of Light, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. You've also got a website for the book, I understand?
We have a website. It's called Crystallia, C-H-R-Y-S-T-A-L-L-I-A, Crystallia.com, and it's also available on Amazon, so...
Now, are you? Have you become a creature of any of the social media? Do you talk on Twitter or Facebook, anything like that? Interact with fans?
I got the Facebook and Twitter thing going. I'm not great at that, you know. I had a blog for a while before Facebook, and I enjoyed being able to share with people what I was thinking about, blah blah blah. And that's not something you can do daily or even weekly. You can't. I mean, you know. How many times do you sit down and say, oh, I have something I want to share with you? I mean, you'd like to be able to share it all, but so it takes a while for it to come out. So I do the Facebook thing occasionally. And then, of course, I've been doing, right now I'm doing kind of a low-end publicity thing. We're rolling this thing out slowly, partially because we wanted to, you know, want to really let it grow. Let the thing grow. People seem to really love it, and the reactions have been very favorable and very positive. And so we're kind of aiming at next Christmas, and you know, and like that. And it's I'm thrilled. I'm very proud of it. I'm very thrilled, and I'm really encouraged by, you know, how positive people react.
Well, Paul Michael Glaser, thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Another good idea? Download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. And you can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of the Internet. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJS or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media Radio, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line at 1-727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show. And unless you live next door to Mr. Media, there may be a toll charge. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube and Vimeo video channels. Thanks so much for joining us today. I always appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.
Hi, this is Guy Kawasaki. You're listening to Mr. Media, you poor slob.
Hey, everybody. This is Bob Andelman from Mr. Media. First of all, I want to thank you for years of support listening to this show. We're starting our sixth year. It's hard to believe our sixth year as 2012 starts and heading towards our 1,000th online podcast, audio and video. It's pretty amazing, frankly. I remember starting it several years ago thinking, this will never last. And podcast, that's as stupid a word as blogging. But here we are, starting our sixth year and heading up to 1,000 interviews. And I want to thank everybody for listening and supporting the show. I also want to tell you that, you know, one of the things that's been very helpful for this show is Stitcher Radio. Yes, this is sort of a commercial. Now, there are millions of smartphone apps in the world, but I only use one several times a day, Stitcher Radio. I build my own radio station to listen to broadcast and online shows when I want and in the order I want. CNN News Update, Onion Radio News, WTF with Mark Maron, MSNBC's Morning Joe, Studio 60, the TechCrunch headlines, and, of course, Mr. Media. It's free. It works on iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Palm Pre, and much more. And you can get it for free for yourself. Try it out. I guarantee you're going to love it. Stitcher.com/MRMedia. That's Stitcher.com/MrMedia. You're going to love it. And thanks again for supporting the show.